I can't tell you how much I miss, not just being here in general, but the music program here. Wonderful sounds that soar so high. Thank you, musicians, one and all. Now, this morning, we were given audience to what might be some important testimony. And perhaps some of us will want to consider it carefully. We heard the testimony, or rather a report of testimony, given secondhand, of alleged evidence found at a gravesite that may or may not have been a crime scene. We heard testimony relevant to a writ of habeas corpus, which of course is Latin for "you have the body." Who had the body? Where was the deceased? The testimony claimed that in addition to the Roman guards, some strange characters were found there. They were described as angels. But the deceased himself was not present. The testimony then proceeded to a rather astonishing claim that the deceased then in fact showed up, alive, not dead, but also not physical. If we were starting at square one with this testimony, there would be an awful lot of careful forensic work that would need to be done here. A crime scene to be meticulously examined and documented. Material witnesses to be questioned carefully. Timelines to be carefully instructed. But we're not starting at square one, are we? We've all heard this testimony before so often that it is hard to even really pay attention to it. We know it pretty well. We know what the text is going to say before it says it, because the testimony we have heard is the most famous testimony in the history of the world. And we heard it secondhand, as I called it, because the form in which it now exists in the world is the community interpretation that was written either in the 7th or the 8th decade of the 1st century, which was several decades after the episode in question actually occurred, allegedly. But we know it is a famous case because I just identified it by giving the decade of the century in which it occurred using a calendarized dating reference that none of you probably question, a calendar scheme used in more than half of the world that's based on the deceased in this testimony. That's based on the claims of this testimony. We now document history by it. And the only reason that that calendar system became normative for billions of people is because the testimony was believed, finally, by a great majority of people at one time in a pretty big part of the world, or I should say an interpretation of the testimony was believed. The interpretation of the testimony of the women who said they experienced and conversed with a man publicly executed and witnessed by a big crowd, that was buttressed by further testimonies in the succeeding weeks by a great many others who claimed not only eyewitness sightings with the supposed deceased, but actual conversations with the deceased. And if truth be told, testimonies of actual experiences with the deceased has never ceased. But the point I'm making is that the testimony we heard is primarily a testament to an interpretation of the testimony of the women and the others. And that testament is that the events surrounding the aftermath of the public execution of Jesus of Nazareth, which include the subsequent sightings and interactions, establish the reality that death is illusory, that human death is illusory and is but a gateway to another life. Eternal life, in fact, and that is the testament. You have to admit, it's quite a fascinating testimony to this testimony that what sprang from a really backwater part of the Mediterranean basin in the Roman Empire has gotten so much traction in history. But is it true? I would make the case that this is an important question, whether it's true. Not everybody agrees with that. Some really don't care, don't believe it really has consequence for what they're going to do this afternoon. The question can be asked, do we need to believe in an afterlife to live a good life? No, we don't. It is not only possible to live ethically, honorably, and courageously with the belief that it is all over when the heart stops pumping, but a great many people do live such lives despite no belief in anything beyond physical life. And does believing in the afterlife, believing this testimony, automatically render one more authentically spiritual? No, it does not. It clearly does not. A great many religionists who claim belief in an afterlife have conducts and behaviors and display attitudes that call their ethics and values into serious question, at least from a Swedenborgian spirituality point of view. Well, then, doesn't that mean that it doesn't matter what the truth is about each of our soul's destiny, and that it isn't really worth so much attention and focus in our spiritual life discourse? I don't think so. It is hard, really, to hold forth very long in a serious forum that what we believe about the destiny of our lives is, in fact, a trivial question. Prima facie. Because the truth of the big picture can make and does make for some people an enormous difference in the way one might set about their living. And over time can be a crucial part of encouraging a more spiritual engagement with life, with spiritual growth lifestyle that can become much more satisfying than if one lives as if there is no tomorrow. Despite the fact that in such an enormous database as the entire human population, you can find lots of examples, just as I described, of people whose beliefs and ethics go in various directions and combinations. It is also true, though, that year after year, psychological studies bear out that a belief in a higher power and higher purpose and in a long-term destiny beyond this life leads to considerably higher degrees of contentment than does a belief that nothing is purposeful or intentional in this creation. Well, a cynic might say, we all know about the placebo effect. People can believe all kinds of things that aren't true, and it will make them feel really better. But it's all based on a falsehood. So how can one admire that? Indeed, I couldn't agree with that more. The truth of the matter is important. Now, can we know anything about the truth? That's the preliminary question. Is the subject too far removed from our grasp that no position on it can really be justified? Is agnosticism the only intellectually defensible position? Or is there evidence that requires the respect of authentic consideration? Now I think we're at the point in this talk when I should reveal, in the interest of full disclosure, that the Swedenborgian Church is an Easter Church par excellence. It is no overstatement to say that Swedenborg wrote more about the question of the soul's destiny, about immortality, and about the afterlife than any other Christian theologian in history. It's not a hyperbolic statement, it's an empirical statement. Partly this fact was because Swedenborg himself became one of those subsequent testifiers about this testimony. from alleged personal experience. He is one of the most studied clairvoyants in history. Swedenborg lived in the so-called Age of Reason, and he was in a social discourse that is not terribly different than ours in some key questions about the big matters of life. Now, let me say a word about his testimony. Even in Swedenborgian circles, it's not really well known because it's tucked away in the materials, but a great turning point came for Swedenborg in 1734. He was in Germany, preoccupied with the task of publishing his Principia. He was already, at the time, Europe's leading mineralogist. His works in metallurgy lasted for over a century in the practices of European mining. But the Principia was about to gain for him a very widespread reputation as one of the most important and up-and-coming natural philosophers. While in Leipzig, for about 5 months, taking the Principia carefully through an elaborate printing process, chapter after chapter, we know from his travel diary that he was greatly affected by the widespread agnosticism and atheism he found in Leipzig, Germany, among the intelligentsia, which he deduced was due to the lack of adequate proof of the soul's immortality and of a divine cause behind the natural world. And right away, he wrote out and published a very skinny little treatise that's called The Infinite and Final Cause of Creation. And in there is a telling sentence that heralds what will be his research program for the next 7 years. Going into the human body, physical anatomical research, and perform the necessary analysis to circumscribe the nature of the soul in the body and demonstrate its ultimate independence from the physical operations of the body. And he will prove all of this empirically in the physical sciences themselves to the satisfaction of those who require laboratory verification. And I am quite sure that there's a good chunk sitting right here, 280 years later, nodding an inner head saying, yes, that would be nice. That'd be nice to have that, Baron Swedenborg. Well, never just a dabbler. Swedenborg's intensive anatomical research, especially on the brain, led to some historically significant discoveries recorded in the annals now of Western scientific history, such as being the first to correctly deduce the function of the cerebrum. No small little matter. And the first to correctly deduce that the brain undulates inside the skull in concert with the lungs, breathing meditation, not the heart rate, not the heart pumping, which was then the conventional conclusion. In a recent book published by MIT Press called Brain, Vision, and Memory, Tales in the History of Neuroscience, Princeton cognitive science scholar Charles Gross presents Swedenborg as an unbelievably prescient intellect working in neuroscience 250 years ahead of his time. But Swedenborg wasn't able to prove empirically in the laboratory the testimony of the women at the tomb in the fashion he was after. The book he published was extremely well received, his book on anatomy and the soul's place in the anatomy, but all the anatomical research findings unfolding in that. Very well received, but he was unhappy. He decided to come at it again. But something else happened on the way. Within a few years into the second phase of his research, he began having experiences in both his dream states and his lucid meditative concentrative states. which seemed to open him to new inner planes in his mind. That's what he experienced. That's what he believed. After several years of this, he believed he began crossing over into actual spiritual worlds, not dreamy states, but very literal realms that were discrete in some ways from this realm altogether, cannot be accessed by the five physical senses, yet intimately, nevertheless, still related. And that he retained this capacity for living in two worlds for the rest of his life. That's his testimony. He did publish a massive book on anatomy. Started on that second work, Envision, as a 17-part multi-volume series. But it all changed for him when he began having, in 1743, really radical experiences. Experiences that were every bit as radical as the women at the tomb. And he left his testimony primarily in a book called Heaven and Hell, his bestseller by far. It's a book that in its day had a very long reach into cultural opinion about things related to the testimony that we heard this morning. Eric Lee Schmidt of Harvard University writes, "Archival records reveal that by the 1820s, Swedenborg's Heaven and Hell rivaled in sales the most popular novels of the day by James Fenimore Cooper and Sir Walter Scott." Swedenborg was presenting what was then an entirely new idea about the soul's survival of physical death that was believed in the dominant religious conversations of the day, ideas of purgatory, ideas of a shadowy realm called Sheol, ideas of living or lying dormant in unconscious death until a second coming and a rising of all souls out of graves, as well as ideas of atheism and fatalism and mere physicalism, that is, that there's no consciousness apart from the physical body. Swedenborg labored to explain that at physical death, the soul awakens right away, immediately, into an alert and very real spiritual existence. This was a new idea. This is a new teaching. It kind of becomes the Swedenborgian Book of the Dead. That's the nickname I give to it. And life, he says, is in many ways very similar to what is known here, only more intense, more real, if you will. But the continuities are striking, and there is still a lot of living, learning, and adventuring yet to come. It's actually the kind of picture that any sane person hopes is true, one of those placebo effects. Give me more of those sugar tablets. If he's right, it's a beautiful life and a beautiful reality that is real. H.W. Janson at New York University, the chairman of the fine arts department there for a long time, after an extensive study of cemetery art in the 19th century, concluded that Swedenborg's popular presentation of what life is like at the moment of death became the most common spiritual belief in the United States. Even still today, the Gallup poll people do an annual study on American religious belief and on the afterlife question. About three-fourths of the people say they think there's probably life after death and that it begins immediately. So in this respect, Swedenborg's legacy has been lasting. Yet it is probably fair to say that in the natural science worlds, there has always existed a great amount of cultural skepticism. One of the most recent additions to my library on this subject is Barbara Bradley Haggerty's book, Fingerprints of God, The Search for the Science of Spirituality. And she's the religion correspondent for National Public Radio, a secular journalist who published this book. And she tackles this question about the evidence of human survival of death from the point of view of a secular journalist just trying to get at the evidence that exists and what is being said in the conversations. She attended conferences at Oxford and Chicago. She did research with others. She read lots of research, met with countless writers and thinkers associated with the questions. And one of the most crucial conclusions she came to is that science isn't following its own standards when it comes to questions such as the soul's ability to exist apart from the body. She focuses especially on near-death research. And her conclusion is that the science community in general is derelict in its unwillingness to confront the evidence and study it, and is not following its own rules of engagement. She says she looked at the mountains of evidence and separated out what she regards as reasonably hard data that a self-respecting scientist would want to explore further. And that data is specifically the testimony of many hundreds at this point, even thousands perhaps. There's no common denominator among them, a truly randomized batch of source testimony from all walks of life, all classes, all religious backgrounds, including atheists and agnostic, who had lucid experiences when clinically at the point of death, who could describe later in vivid detail what went on around them as they hovered outside their physical body. And then here's the clincher, details that can be corroborated by others who were present in the situation. Starting to size up as pretty serious, at least sociological data. But the focus on the testimony there can be investigated. The great majority in the science community, however, due to its a priori opinions and philosophical commitments, chooses largely to ignore it. But the agnostic Barbara Bradley Haggerty says that her research caused her to change her mind about the big questions. She no longer feels agnosticism is a position she can inhabit with integrity. She says the evidence is pretty strong that something more is going on than a brain animated only by physical properties of the body. So, actually, over 2,000 years later, we've got a lot of testimony to consider around this original Easter event. What is the evidence for or against the idea that the human soul exists independently of the physical body and survives the body's death? You know, we frequently value testimonies about other people's experiences. That's what Yelp is all about. When it comes to so many things in life, we tend to always trust a preponderance of testimony. Hey, 85 out of 90 Yelp say this restaurant's really good. It's got to be good. It probably is excellent. We do consider testimonies to be real evidence when it aggregates into something statistically significant. It isn't necessarily conclusive, but it is not vacant of significance. We don't have to have the experience directly in order to conclude some likelihoods about a matter. Another impressive roster of testifiers of Yelpers going all the way back to the gospel called Matthew are giving 5 stars to God's great universe. There are millions and millions giving a Facebook thumbs up, I like it, tagging the message we've heard today. There's a great deal more than meets the physical sense eye. So let's roll the tombstone away from our mind's inner eye and see not death in front of us, not death around us, but life. The extraordinarily amazing power and purpose in our own lives with God and with gazillions others like us forever.